severely through all of her diets. On her journey to becoming an intuitive eater, Alice learned to counter the messages of the food police with the supportive messages of the nurturer. She listened to herself speak to her family and realized that the voice she used when speaking to them was the same voice that she needed to comfort herself. Alice learned to be understanding of the stumbling blocks in her path and to patiently reassure herself that she was in the midst of a process. When she would have difficulty honoring her hunger, she gently asked herself what was bothering her and what she really needed instead of food. When she found herself craving a food she had restricted on one of her many diets, the nurturer gave her permission to eat that food. How it helps. When you get in touch with a nurturer inside your head, you will experience one of the most significant tools to becoming an intuitive eater. The nurturer will be there for you to help you to challenge the food police and support you through this process. The nurturer provides coping statements for the harsh zingers that the food police and the diet rebel can throw. The intuitive eater. The intuitive eater speaks from your gut reactions. You were born an intuitive eater, but this persona has probably been suppressed for most of your life by the voices of the food police, prevailing in your family and in society, the diet rebel, and the nutrition informant. The intuitive eater is a compilation of the positive voices of the food anthropologist, who is able to observe your eating behavior neutrally, and the nurturer, who holds you with supportive statements to get you through the tough times, as well as the rebel ally and the nutrition ally. The intuitive eater knows how to argue the negative voices out of your head. For example, it knows how to challenge the distorted messages of the food police and how to get the rebel ally to speak out loud to fend off the boundary invaders. The intuitive eater voice might say some of the following things. That little rumble in my stomach means I'm hungry and need to eat. What do I feel like eating for dinner tonight? What sounds good to me? It feels so good to be out of that dieting prison. These statements all tell you about your gut reactions. They're instinctual and hit you out of nowhere without your having to think about them. You'll find that you'll be in the midst of a meal and the intuitive eater voice knows that you're satisfied. Or you'll be doing some writing and a hunger pang will emerge. Or maybe your eyes lock onto the food on the menu that connects with your craving. When you have reached the last stages of your path to intuitive eating, the intuitive eater rather than the dieter will prevail most of the time. But there will be times when you find that you'll need to evoke one or all of the positive eating voices to help you get centered and in touch with your intuitive eater once again. There are no rigid rules in this process. Diets are rigid. Intuitive eating is fluid and adapts to the many changes in your life. Go with the flow without trying to control it. The integrated intuitive eater honors gut reactions, whether they are biological, satisfaction-based, or self-protective. The intuitive eater is a team player and can draw from the voices of the nurturer, the food anthropologist, and the positive traits of both the diet rebel, the rebel ally, and the nutrition informant, the nutrition ally. Eating voices, how they emerge and evolve. Each of the voices may prevail at different times. Some of the voices were there at birth, but may have become buried. Others were instilled by family and society. And some need to be learned and developed to become an intuitive eater. You're born with the innate ability to sense when you're hungry and full. These are primitive signals and are the basis for the emerging voice of the intuitive eater, which is operating in the toddler as he or she starts eating solid food. The intuitive eater tells you what you like and what you don't like. If your parents are not sensitive to your signals, you may learn to mistrust them and ultimately lose touch with them. If you happen to live in a family that has weight and eating issues, You may have your first experience with the voice of the food police when you are still very young. You may be told to stop eating so much or be restricted from eating certain foods. It doesn't take long before you internalize those negative messages and create your own powerful food police. If, on the other hand, you're lucky enough to have a family who is not invasive, making no food or body judgments, you may not encounter the food police until you start school, or until you become a teen, reading magazines and listening to your friends talk. If the pressure to be thin is strong in your community, you are at risk of making the food police messages your own at any time in your life. And the nutrition informant constantly feeds nutrition information about food to the food police. The voice of the diet rebel will crop up soon after you've encountered the food police. It usually goes hand in hand. The food police come in and invade your boundaries by interfering with your intuitive biological and food preference signals. In order to protect your private space, the diet rebel feeds you "forget you" messages that not only counter the food police, but often send you off into a one-person food riot. The food anthropologist will help give you a neutral perspective. For some individuals, interaction with this voice is often the first non-judgmental, non-negative encounter with food. The nurturer can get you through outside abuse and your own self-defeating behavior if you have access to its positive voice. If your family has given you a sense that you're competent and adequate and has modeled positive ways of coping, you may easily find the voice of your nurturer to combat the societal voices of the food police. If, however, your family has colluded with society and you have grown up with criticism and judgment, the nurturer will have to be found elsewhere. Sometimes a grandparent, aunt or uncle, or dear friend may teach you how to speak kindly to yourself. For some, seeking help from a psychotherapist or dietitian may be the first experience with learning positive self-talk. However you learn to bring forth the voice of the nurturer, this is a critical step in becoming an intuitive eater. You must make it available to yourself so you can buffer the negative voices which bombard you without notice and cause a barrier to your progress. And finally, you find yourself back at that place where the intuitive eater is running the show. The intuitive eater integrates the voices of the nurturer and the food anthropologist, the nutrition ally and the rebel ally. The intuitive eater knows when your biological signals are calling. It tells you what you need and want, and with guidance from the other positive voices, helps you make adult, neutral decisions about how you will take care of yourself. Let's now take an eating situation and listen for the dialogue of voices that can affect its outcome. You've been invited to dinner at the home of a gourmet cook. Many appetizers will be served during the cocktail hour, and later a spectacular dinner will be placed before you. Unfortunately, you arrive at the party in an over-hungry state. The food police: you'd better be careful of what you eat. Everything is fattening. Don't touch the appetizers. If you even taste that little quiche, you're a goner. And you can be sure you'll be tempted with lots of rich desserts. Watch out. The nutrition informant: you shouldn't have any cheese because there's too much fat in it, and the salt will make you feel bloated. You can only eat the raw veggies. The diet rebel: nobody is going to tell me what I can eat at this party. I hate that stupid diet. I've had to succumb to cardboard crackers and diet cottage cheese. Well, not tonight. I'm going to get my fill of these amazing foods. I don't care what happens to my diet. I don't care if I'm fat. I'll show my wife what she can do with comments about my weight. The food anthropologist: look at the interesting array of appetizers. A lot of them look great. You're overly hungry. Better eat something or you'll probably overeat at dinner. The nutrition ally: I don't think I'll have any cheese or fried appetizers tonight. They're very rich and will make me feel too full for dinner. I'd rather have some crab and veggies now so I can still have some hunger for dinner. The Nurturer. This food looks terrific. I want to taste everything. It's scary to feel such an overwhelming desire to devour these appetizers. That's okay. It's normal to feel this way when you're ravenous. This isn't the usual situation, and I'm human. The Intuitive Eater. I'm very hungry. But I think I'll pace myself so I won't feel too full to enjoy the dinner later. Let's see if all the appetizers which look the best. Oh, I haven't had pizza in a long time. That looks good. And so does the baked brie. I think I'll try them both. The brie is great, but the pizza is kind of soggy. Think I'll throw it out and taste the stuffed mushrooms. Halfway through dinner. This is delicious, but I'm starting to feel full. One more bite and I'll feel satisfied. I feel great getting to eat anything I like and leaving some of it without feeling deprived. The Rebel Ally, to the hostess who is pushing seconds. The dinner is delicious, but I'm quite full and couldn't eat another helping. Thanks anyway. Summary. How the food voices help or harm. Voice, food police. How it harms. Causes guilt and food worry, full of judgment. Keeps you in the dieting world and out of touch with inner cues of eating. How it helps? It doesn't. Voice, nutrition informant. How it harms? Uses nutrition as a vehicle to keep you dieting. How it helps? Once uncoupled from the food police, it becomes the nutrition ally and can help you make healthy food choices without guilt. Voice, diet rebel. How it harms. Usually results in overeating, self-sabotage. How it helps. When the diet rebel becomes the rebel ally, it can help you guard your food turf boundaries. Voice, food anthropologist. How it harms, it doesn't. How it helps, a neutral observer that can give you a distant perspective into your eating world. Non-judgmental. Keeps you in touch with your inner signals, biologically and psychologically. Voice, nurturer. How it harms, it doesn't. How it helps, helps to disarm the verbal assault from the food police. Gets you through the tough times. Self-talk. Special arsenal for challenging the food police. Identifying the inner voices is useful for challenging the food police, but this powerfully negative voice requires more ammunition. The food police can throw many tricks that require special attention, especially in the thought process department. When working with dieters in our offices, we have seen over and over that there is actually a middle step between the initial dieting thought and the subsequent eating behavior. We have found that the inner dieting myths, which are cognitive distortions, lead to feeling bad when the self-imposed dieting rules are broken. This concept is widely accepted and well explained by Dr. Albert Ellis and Dr. Robert A. Harper, highly respected pioneers in the field of rational emotive psychotherapy, a system of psychotherapy which deals with the effect of our thoughts on our feelings and then our behaviors. According to Ellis and Harper, we routinely flood our heads with crazy notions as well as sane and rational messages. These thought processes are called internalized sentences or self-talk. Negative self-talk often makes us feel despair. The feeling of despair can trigger sabotaging behaviors. Ellis and Harper believe that if we challenge the nonsense in our heads, we'll end up feeling better. When we feel better, we'll act better. In a review of hundreds of research studies of this type of therapy, it has been shown that if we can first change our beliefs, our feelings and behaviors will also change in a chain-like reaction. Therefore, it makes sense to examine our food or diet beliefs and the influence they can have. Here's a favorite story that illustrates this principle. Let's say that you've been a dieter who has been carefully following your diet for several weeks. Your diet is low fat, and prohibits any kind of sugary, fatty desserts. You decide that you're going to visit your grandmother, whom you haven't seen for a while. You walk into Grandma's house, and the first thing that strikes you is the enticing aroma of chocolate brownies hot out of the oven. Here are the food beliefs and thoughts that might fill your head. I've been so good on my diet the last few weeks. I haven't had any ice cream or candy or cookies. I'd sure love to have one of those brownies, but I can't. I shouldn't. I won't. If I have a brownie, I'll blow my diet. I won't be able to stop eating the brownies. Oh, maybe just one will be okay. You eat the brownie. Oh, no. I shouldn't have done that. That was really stupid. I have no willpower. I'm going to be out of control. It's all my fault that I'm fat. Will I ever be able to lose weight? Now, let's sense what you are feeling. Disappointment, fear of future deprivation, sadness, fear of being out of control, despair. Typical eating behavior that follows will be something like this. You slowly take a second brownie, and a third brownie. Before you know it, you've gobbled up the whole plateful. You collapse on the couch, stuffed and miserable, and fall right to sleep. Now, let's see how challenging your basic food beliefs can change your feelings and your behavior. The beliefs and thoughts. I'm so glad I gave up dieting. I can eat anything I want, anytime I want. I'd sure love to have one of those brownies. You eat the brownie. Boy, that was delicious. I'm satisfied with just this one. There's nothing like Grandma's home-baked chocolate brownies. And now the feelings. Satisfaction, pleasure, contentment. No worry about future deprivation. And the behavior. You leave the rest of the brownies on the plate. You put the plate of brownies on the kitchen counter. You're free to enjoy the afternoon with Grandma without another thought about the brownie. Andrea is a college student who had been suffering from years of bouts of low self-esteem associated with her dieting failures. For a short time, she actually became bulimic when she saw no other way to control the binging that inevitably followed her dieting falls from grace. Andrea was an expert at telling herself that carbohydrates were bad and that even a few grams of fat in a day would mar her good eating behavior. Belief. As soon as these thoughts formed in her head, she felt bad the moment she would eat carbohydrates. The conflict between her restrictive thoughts and her craving for the forbidden food always created angry and hateful feelings. When she felt bad in her mode of shaky willpower, she was off and running to her latest eating disaster. Behavior. As soon as Andrea succumbed to her natural desires to eat that food, the system of negative thinking led to negative feelings, which led to negative behavior. Andrea has learned to check her food thoughts as soon as they arise. Old diet rules and thoughts get challenged immediately. Because she is free from distorted dieting thoughts, she feels better about herself and eating. Instead of feeling bad about wanting French fries or ice cream, she feels great about her new relationship with food. And, you guessed it, her binging days are over. Negative self-talk and how to change it. For there is nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. To me, it is a prison. Hamlet. When eating thoughts are irrational or distorted, negative feelings escalate exponentially. As a result, eating behavior can end up extreme and destructive. It's the classic case of perception becomes reality. Therefore, to change our food reality, we need to replace the irrational thinking with rational thoughts. This, in turn, helps to moderate our feelings and then behavior. To get rid of distorted diet thoughts, you first need to identify irrational thinking. Ask yourself, am I having repetitive and intense feelings? This is a clue that you need to challenge your thoughts. What am I thinking that's leading me to feel this way? What are you saying to yourself? What is true or correct about this belief? What is false? Examine and confront the distorted beliefs that support this thinking. Your food anthropologist voice can be very helpful here. Once you have uncovered your distorted beliefs, you need to replace them with thoughts and beliefs that are more rational and reasonable. Here's one example, but the remainder of this chapter will show you how to do this in various ways. Replace this distorted thought. Every time I eat pizza, I'm much fatter the next day. With a more rational thought. I am salt sensitive. Since pizza is pretty salty, I'm most likely bloated. This isn't fat, it's just water retention. It's temporary. Irrational beliefs often present themselves to us through negative self-talk. Let's examine the various types of negative thinking and how you can recognize their signs before they drag you into the ditches of overeating. Dichotomous thinking. When I furnished my first office, I purposely chose gray fabric for the couches. I decided that it was a symbolic gesture to help my patients get away from the black and white thinking that usually coexists with the diet mentality. Here are some typical examples of dichotomous thinking. When you get on the scale in the morning and it drops a pound, you say that you've been good. If it goes up a pound, you're bad. When you're dieting, you think in terms of all or none. You're not allowed to have any cookies. And if you eat one, you think and feel that you must finish them all. With dichotomous thinking comes black and white behaviors. Here are some typical eating examples. Eating none or eating all. Never eating snacks or always eating snacks. Always eating alone or partying all of the time. Dichotomous or black and white thinking can be dangerous and is often based on the premise of achieving perfection. It gives you only two alternatives, one of which is usually neither attainable or maintainable. The other then tends to be the black hole in which you inevitably fall after failing to get to the first. You set your sights so high, constantly chasing an ideal that you can grasp only moments at a time. When the standard for being okay is this lofty, you're destined to feel lousy most of the time. And we know that when you feel lousy, you're bound to end up going off the deep end in your eating behavior. For example, Hillary is a client who set herself up for failure by thinking in a black and white manner. She would give herself permission to eat only when she felt ravenous. If she ate when just moderately hungry, she would consider it overeating. As a result of thinking that she had blown it when she didn't meet her starving standard, she would feel awful and then go into a binge. When you think in terms of how good or bad your eating is or how fat or thin your body is, you can end up judging your self-worth based on these thoughts. If you begin to feel that you're a bad person, you're likely to create self-punishing behaviors. Ray is a young woman who set up perfectionist standards in her eating style throughout her high school days. She never allowed herself to eat anything with sugar, artificial sweeteners, salt, or fat in it. As a result, she consistently maintained a super thin, even unhealthy weight. When Ray got to college and was away from the familiarity of home, she found that her standards were becoming impossible to keep up. As soon as she began to expand her food choices as a result of availability, temptation, and peer pressure, things began to fall apart for Ray. As a dichotomous thinker, her thoughts began to run like this. The only correct way to eat is the way I ate in high school. This new kind of eating is bad and will make me fat. I've lost my willpower to eat in the right way. The only way I can eat now is wrong. That's bad. I'm bad, and I deserve to feel bad. Ray ultimately began to binge as a result of her dichotomous thinking and was willing to acknowledge that much of her binging behavior was done as a way to punish herself for her bad acts. The binging made her feel increasingly worse, But, ironically, this was okay with her as she felt that she deserved the punishment. Ray ended up gaining a significant amount of weight and is only now learning to change her thinking. She stopped talking to herself negatively, is beginning to feel better, has stopped punishing herself with binging, and is slowly returning to a normal weight. How do you get out of the dichotomous thinking trap? Go for the gray. Gray may seem to be a dull color, while black and white are dramatic extremes. In the world of eating, however, going for the gray can give you a rainbow of choices. Give up the notion that you must eat in an all-or-nothing fashion. Let go of your old black-and-white dieting rules. Allow yourself to eat the foods that were always restricted, while checking your thoughts to be sure that they support your choices. You'll find that the thrill of being in the white area of diet restriction is gone, but so is the misery of being in the black area of out-of-control behavior. Absolutist thinking. When you think in this way, you believe that one behavior will absolutely, irrevocably result in a second behavior. This is considered magical thinking, because in reality you can't and don't control life in this way. It leads you to believe that you must act in a certain way or else something awful will happen. In the world of eating, absolutist thinking will lead you to statements like the following. I must eat perfectly these next 2 months, or else I won't lose enough weight for my daughter's wedding, and that would be awful. You don't really have any proof that eating perfectly will actually cause you to lose enough weight. You're not even sure what enough weight actually means, and you really can't define this awful state that you imagine. You end up feeling frantic trying to eat perfectly, and then, of course, eat imperfectly. Fearing that you won't lose enough weight makes you more anxious, and believing that will be awful turns you into a wreck. The result, of course, of all these absolute thoughts and anxious feelings is destructive overeating behavior, which leads you to the opposite end of what you wished. You might even gain weight before the wedding and feel all the worse. How do you get out of this kind of thinking? Banish the absolutes and replace them with permissive statements. Carefully listen for the absolute words that you use. Get rid of the musts, oughts, shoulds, need-tos, supposed-tos, and have-tos. Every time you think that you must go on a diet, or you need to lose 10 pounds before the reunion, or you ought to have a light lunch like a salad and tea, or you shouldn't eat before you go to bed, stop yourself and replace those thoughts. Those kinds of words and thoughts will only cause you anxiety about not being able to carry out the command. Thinking in this absolute way has no guarantee of resulting in the behavior you desire and is likely to create self-sabotaging behavior. In fact, it's fairly sure to make the result awful, which is just what you're trying to avoid. Use words such as can, is okay, and may. Give yourself permissive statements such as, it's okay if I don't lose weight before the wedding. I can eat whenever I'm hungry. If I want, I can eat whatever foods I like. I may have anything that looks good to me. Catastrophic thinking. Each time that you think in exaggerated ways, you create miserable feelings for yourself and, once again, compensate by extreme behaviors. The following are examples of catastrophic thoughts. I'll never be thin. It's hopeless. I'll never get a boyfriend or a job at this weight. My life is ruined because I'm so fat. If I let myself eat candy bars and fries, I'll eat them forever. This kind of thinking is a real setup. It makes a bad situation worse and ties all of your future successes in life to your ability to eat in a particular way or to losing weight. You tell yourself that all your happiness hinges on your eating and your body. If that is your premise, then you're bound to feel all the more unhappy than you are at the moment. You may be desperately unhappy about your weight right now, but you may become despairing by catastrophizing your bleak future. Marion is a highly successful screenwriter who owns her own home, has many devoted friends, and two loving dogs. But Marion feeds herself a daily litany of catastrophic thoughts. Because she's overweight, she tells herself that she'll never get married, never have children, and never be happy. Looking forward to this negative, self-created future only makes her feel miserable and causes her to overeat to comfort herself. How do you get away from catastrophic thinking? Climb out of the abyss. Replace your exaggerated thoughts with thinking, which is more positive and accurate. Treat yourself to hopeful coping statements. Marion is learning to nurture herself by telling herself that many overweight people find spouses who love them as they are. She's practicing positive self-talk that confirms her current as well as her future happiness. As a result, Marion is eating less and is accepting her weight. She knows that she'll never return to her episodes of negative self-talk. Pessimistic thinking, or the cup is half empty. People who view the world in this way tend to see every situation in its worst-case scenario. They usually think that life is terrible, that they don't have enough of what they want, and that everything they do is wrong. They're highly critical and blameful, not only of themselves, but of others. Bonnie walks into the office each week with a scowl. She complains about her husband and her job and says that her children are driving her crazy. She begins each session with accounts of how terrible her week has been and how badly she has blown her eating. Bonnie would evaluate the cup as half empty. This kind of negative thinking is insidious and often goes unnoticed by the participant. It needs to be pointed out on a regular basis so the person can reevaluate her thought process and see that it only leads to a pervasive sense of unhappiness. It also perpetuates self-destructive behaviors. A person who thinks this way has great difficulty appreciating her small successes. She often even misses them and tends to condemn her progress. How do you get out of this kind of thinking? Make the cup half full. The most obvious way to heal cup is half empty thinking is to consciously catch each of your negative statements and replace the words with more positive ones. Half empty, I had a terrible week. Half full, I had some success this week. Half empty, I overate so many times. Half full, I had many times when I honored my hunger. Half empty, all I ate was sweets. Half full, I had more sweets than I wished, but I had lots of other foods too. Half empty, I feel so fat. Half full, I'm feeling better about myself. Half empty, I'm such a failure. Half full, I'm doing better little by little. After you have done this consciously for a while, you'll find that you hear your own negative thoughts transform into more positive words. You will also become sensitive to how hard you've been on yourself. Once you begin to see the world in terms of the cup being half full, you'll find your daily dose of happy moments increases regularly. Soon you'll see much of your negative eating habits disappear, along with the negative thoughts. Linear thinking. If you've been on even one diet, you'll know that diet thinking goes in one straight line. You begin at your initial weight, and all you can think about is getting to your goal weight. You follow a very specific plan that allows for no deviations. It's like trying to walk along the white line in the middle of the highway to get to your destination. If you put one foot in front of the other in perfect style, you'll successfully make it to the end. If you accidentally step off the line for even a moment, you're likely to be a highway disaster. We tend to be a society of linear thinkers. We want to get to the goal without appreciating the means. We're success-oriented and rarely stop long enough to just be and check out the scenery along the way. Here are some examples of linear thinking that can set you up. All that is important is that I lose this weight. The faster I lose weight, the more successful I am. To be successful, I must reach my goal weight by the specified target date. I will lose 2 pounds per week with no fluctuations. How do you get out of this kind of thinking? Switch to process thinking. The cure for linear thinking is process thinking, which focuses on continual change and learning rather than just the end result. If you start thinking in terms of what you can learn along the way and accept that there will be many ups and downs, you will go forward. By becoming a process thinker, you will enjoy the opportunity to enrich many aspects of your life while recreating your relationship with food. Process thinking will help you become more sensitive to your intuitive eating signals rather than endpoints such as how much you ate today. Here are some examples of process thinking. This was a rough week, but I learned some new things about myself that will help me make changes in the future. What's most important is that I honor the positive changes I'm making in my eating, not my weight loss. I ate more than I wanted to at the restaurant tonight, especially the dessert. But I learned that by giving myself permission to eat dessert, it took away the urgency to have sweets again later. Usually I would have binged when I got home, alone. Self-awareness, the ultimate weapon against the food police. The next time that you see yourself eating in a way that feels uncomfortable, unsatisfying, or even out of control, give yourself the gift of remembering what you were thinking before you even took the first bite of food. Examine that thought and challenge it. As you get more adept at the intuitive eating process, you'll be able to catch these thoughts before they make you feel bad or cause undesirable behavior. Become self-aware. Pay attention to the food talk that inevitably arises when you approach any eating situation. Listen for the different voices that can either serve as your support or saboteur. Banish the food police that keep you from making your peace with food. Challenge the pseudo-nutrition thoughts that come from the nutrition informant. Observe your eating through the eyes and voice of your food anthropologist and allow it to guide you sensibly. Speak out loud the thoughts of your rebel ally so you don't use food to take care of you. The real protection will come from your nurturer, who knows just how to soothe you and get you through tough situations. And finally, become acutely sensitive to the positive voices that comprise your intuitive eater. It was there when you were born. Discard the layers of negative voices that have buried it so deeply that it seemed lost forever. By listening to its instinctual signals, you'll have the opportunity to form a healthy relationship with food. Chapter 9, Principle 5, Feel Your Fullness. Listen for the body signals that tell you that you are no longer hungry. Observe the signs that show that you're comfortably full. Pause in the middle of eating and ask yourself how the food tastes and what your current hunger level is. The vast majority of chronic dieters we have worked with belong to the Clean Plate Club, and most of them say that they've tried not to clean their plates. It may seem that an obvious step to normalizing your eating is to respect your fullness rather than to habitually clean your plate. Yet leaving food on the plate can be difficult to achieve, especially for the chronic dieter. Dieting instills a license to eat at mealtime when it is legal. Ironically, this sense of entitlement reinforces a clean-your-plate mentality. This is particularly true for our clients who have sipped on over-the-counter liquid diets such as SlimFast. Liquid diet programs typically have you drink a beverage meal for breakfast and lunch and then allow you to eat a sensible dinner of real food. Naturally, most of our parents practically lick their plates clean when given the opportunity to eat their one real meal. It's not that they overate. Rather, they ate all a of their precise and entitled portions. Other diet plans using regular food typically offer small portions at meals. This, too, encourages you to eat while you can. Who would leave any morsel of food when quantities are meager? For example, even frozen diet meals hover at about 300 calories, and often less, which usually leaves you less than satisfied. In fact, there is a trend of frozen diet entrees offering even fewer calories, closer to 200 calories per package. This type of eating hardly fosters getting in touch with your inner eating signals, especially signals of satiety. Instead, you eat it all. Perhaps you've tossed your diet plans out years ago, but now carefully count fat grams. You may find, however, that you clean your plate when it comes to eating fat-free foods. We've had several clients eat an entire package of fat-free chocolate cake or other fat-free goodies with carefree abandonment because of the entitlement factor. They would rationalize that there's no fat, so I can eat as much as I want. Unfortunately, fat-free is not necessarily calorie-free. But the calories wouldn't even be an issue if people were respecting their fullness level. Of course, other factors can easily condition you to polish off every crumb on your plate, including having been taught to finish everything on your plate by well-meaning parents. Respecting economics and the value of food, thou shalt not waste. Remember, however, that either way the food can be wasted. In the case of chronically eating more than you need, it becomes an issue of WAIST. Having an ingrained habit of eating to completion. Out of sheer habit, you finish an entire plate of food, or a whole hamburger, or a whole bag of chips, regardless of how hungry or full you are. This is a reliance on external cues. You stop eating when the food is gone, regardless of the size of the initial portion. Beginning a meal or snack in an overly ravenous state. In this state, eating intensity is revved up, and it's all too easy to bypass normal satiety cues. Even if you don't clean your plate, it's still possible that you may be overeating or bypassing your comfortable satiety level. With our clients who don't clean their plates, we have often discovered that while there may still be food left on the plate, it took an uncomfortable level of fullness to get them to stop eating. The problem is the inability to recognize comfortable satiety or to respect fullness. The key to respecting fullness. Respecting fullness, or the ability to stop eating because you have had enough to eat biologically, hinges critically on giving yourself unconditional permission to eat. Principle 3. Make peace with food. How can you or any dieter expect to leave food on your plate if you believe that you won't be able to eat that particular food or meal again? Unless you truly give yourself permission to eat again when you are hungry or have access to that particular food, respecting fullness simply becomes a dogmatic dieting exercise without roots. It won't take hold. The intuitive eater in training learns to stop eating when he or she has had just enough to fill the stomach comfortably without being overfull. It's easier to stop eating at this point and leave food behind when you know you can eat it again later. Recognizing comfortable satiety. We are surprised at how often our clients do not know what comfortable satiety feels like. Oh, yes, they can usually describe with great detail how overeating or overstuffed feels, but knowledge of what comfortable satiety feels like is often elusive, especially to the chronic dieter. Yet, if you do not know what comfortable satiety feels like, how can you expect to achieve it? It's like trying to shoot at a target without ever seeing it or to even know where it resides. When respecting fullness is the target, it could easily be missed if you are not looking for it, especially when you have been conditioned to clean your plate. Also, if you start eating when you are not hungry, it's hard to know when to stop out of fullness. How do you imagine comfortable satiety feels? Here are some common descriptions offered by our clients. a subtle feeling of stomach fullness, feeling satisfied and content. Nothingness, neither hungry nor full. The sensation is highly individual, and while we can describe it endlessly, it's akin to trying to tell someone what snow feels like. We can give you a good idea, but it's something that needs to be experienced at the personal level so that you know what it feels like in your body. How to respect your fullness. When you habitually clean your plate, your eating style easily evolves into autopilot. You eat until completion, until the food is gone. To break this pattern of eating, we have found it helpful to be keenly aware or hyper-conscious of your eating. This means being conscious or mindful of your eating experience. While you may certainly be aware that you are engaged in the act of eating, we find that somewhere between bites 1 and 100, there is a significant level of unconsciousness. Quite often the food is not even being tasted. Likewise, it's all too easy to bypass comfortable satiety. Here are some examples. I wasn't aware of how much candy I would eat at the movies until suddenly my hands were scratching at the bottom of an empty box. I wouldn't even consider splitting a meal when eating out until my boss asked if I would split an entree at her favorite restaurant. Begrudgingly, I agreed. To my surprise, I was thoroughly satisfied with half an entree, knowing all too well that had I ordered the full portion, I would have eaten it all, out of sheer habit. Once I opened up a package of any food, I had to eat it all. God forbid I'd leave a few tidbits. I know I'm not even tasting the food most of the time. Conscious eating. This initial step away from the blind autopilot eating mode is conscious eating. It's a phase where you neutrally observe your eating as if under a microscope. Your food anthropologist voice will be very helpful here. We have broken this stage into a series of steps, which begins with taking a mini time out from eating. This will help you regroup and assess where you're at in your eating. It's like a timeout that athletes and coaches take during a game to help improve their play or strategy. Here's what to do. Pause in the middle of a meal or snack for a timeout. Keep in mind that this timeout or pause is not a commitment to stop eating. Rather, it's a commitment to be in check with your body and taste buds. If you thought that by pausing you were obligated to leave food on your plate, you'd be reluctant to go through this step. In fact, many of our clients who initially appeared resistant to this step later admitted that they were afraid that they would have to stop eating from that point on. During this timeout, perform these checks. Taste check. We find that this check is usually pleasurable, which is why we like to begin with it. Ask yourself how the food tastes. Is it worthy of your taste buds? Or are you continuing to eat just because it's there? Satiety check. Ask yourself what your hunger or fullness level is. Are you still hungry? Do you feel unsatisfied? Or is your hunger going away and are you beginning to feel satisfied? In the beginning, this may seem like a hit or miss process. Be patient. And remember, you are getting to know yourself from the inside out. Just as you would not expect to get to know a person over one meal, how could you expect to understand your satiety levels in one meal or snack? It will take time. However, the more in tune you are with your hunger level and the more you honor your hunger, the easier this step will be. Remember to be open to any answer. There can be considerable fluctuation in your fullness level depending upon the last time you ate and what you ate. If you find you're still hungry, then resume eating. When you finish eating, whatever the amount, ask yourself where your fullness level is now. Did you reach comfortable satiety? Did you surpass it? By how much? Discovering your fullness level will help you identify your last bite threshold. This is the end point. You know that the bite of food in your mouth is your last. Fini. It may take you a long time to get to this point. The longer you have been disconnected from your body's sense of fullness, the longer it will take to identify this point. If you honor your hunger, principle two, it is much easier to know fullness. If, however, you do not eat from biological hunger, how could you expect to stop from biological fullness, or to even know what it feels like? Please be patient with yourself. Don't feel obligated to leave food on your plate. If you find that you have a level of resistance for this activity, it may be from past dieting experience. You may be feeling obligated to leave food on your plate, which is a remnant of the diet mentality. Remember, there is no commitment to leave food on your plate. The commitment, instead, is to getting to know your satiety level and your taste buds. It's perfectly normal, even when you discover your specific satiety level, to opt to overeat. That's okay. We have found that many clients continue to opt for more food. They are still testing the unconditional permission to eat. After a while, when the newness wears off and the deprivation feelings subside, you will find that it's quite easy to leave food on your plate. It does require, however, a degree of consciousness, checking in with yourself. But if most of the time you can recognize your fullness and respect it, it will make a considerable difference in your physical comfort level and peace of mind. How to increase consciousness? It's very difficult to do two conscious things at once. While you certainly may juggle a zillion activities, your mind focuses primarily on one. That's why, for example, so many people lock their keys in their car. Their minds are focused somewhere else, such as getting into the office on time or unloading the groceries. We find that to get the most out of eating, it needs to be a conscious activity whenever possible. Eat without distraction. Value and enjoy the eating experience when possible. For example, Adele, a fast-paced, hard-driven lawyer, always made the best use of her time and would usually eat while doing something else. Adele would read briefs while eating lunch at work and dine with a magazine at home. She took a step forward when she decided to try eating without distraction when at home. She was too busy at work to even consider just eating lunch. Adele discovered that if she ate a meal or snack at home without engaging in reading, she would usually eat less. To her surprise, she learned that she ate less not because she was trying to eat smaller amounts, but because she would detect her fullness level much sooner. She was thrilled that, without trying, she was eating less food, feeling satisfied without deprivation, and not dieting. Adele was willing to eat this way at home, but did not view it as realistic for work. And this was progress. Many clients have taken the suggestion to eat without distraction as a hard and fast rule, and feel guilty if they happen to read the newspaper with breakfast or have a snack watching TV. Remember, intuitive eating is not another diet with rules to be broken. As in every other aspect of intuitive eating, you are the one who has the internal wisdom about what works for you. You also know what doesn't work. Whatever the other activity may be honest with yourself about whether you are able to get the most satisfaction in your eating while engaging in this activity, or whether you're being distracted by it. Reinforce your conscious decision to stop. Many of our clients have found that when they decide to stop eating because they've reached the last bite threshold, it's helpful to do something to make it a conscious act, such as gently nudging the plate forward half an inch or putting their utensils or napkin on their plate. This simply reminds them of their decision. Otherwise, it may be all too easy to innocently nibble on the remaining food, even though you had no intention of doing so. If you have trouble with the idea of wasting food, try putting your leftovers away for tomorrow's lunch or dinner, or giving them to a homeless person. If you're going to a restaurant, try bringing a small cooler to keep the food safe until you get home. Defend yourself from obligatory eating. This usually means practicing saying, "No, thank you." I never realized the significance of this act until I attended a very elegant cocktail party in which there seemed to be one waiter for each guest. The moment my hand was empty of food or drink, an all-too-eager waiter was there to offer more food or beverage. I found it was so much easier to say yes, especially if I was in the middle of a conversation. It took much more energy, however, to say no. The same is true if you attend any function in which there are well-meaning food pushers, from the gracious host to the obnoxious relative. A special caution to those of you who enjoy wine by the bottle at a good restaurant: a good server will often keep your glass full. Unless you are conscious of that, you may drink more than you intend. Remember, you are in charge of how much to eat and drink. The fullness factors. I just ate 2 hours ago. I honored my hunger and respected my fullness. So how could I be hungry again so soon? While the ebb and tide of satiety signals may seem puzzling, it's quite normal to have different degrees of hunger and fullness, especially when you begin listening to your body's eating cues. There are also several factors that affect fullness. These factors are both biological and learned. When you have a general understanding of some of these satiety factors, it makes it easier to trust your body and feel your fullness. The ability to recognize comfortable satiety or fullness can ultimately determine how much food will be consumed in a meal. And the amount of food eaten in a meal is influenced by these fullness factors: the amount of time that has passed since the last time you ate. The more often you eat, the less hungry you will be. This has been found to be true in nibbling studies. These are studies in which people are given several snacks or mini-meals throughout the day. The nibblers are consistently less hungry than those fed identical calories divided into 3 meals. While the purpose of these studies was to examine the metabolic effects of snacking compared to traditional meals, the researchers have consistently noted that the nibblers were less hungry, even though calories and fat were identical in both groups. The kind of food you eat. The macronutrients, protein, carbohydrates, and fat, influence subsequent food intake by their contribution to the total amount of food energy in the stomach. Other food factors, such as fiber, will also affect the fullness factor because of its bulk and water retention properties. Protein, in particular, seems to have a suppressive effect on intake beyond its contribution to total calories, according to several studies. The amount of food still remaining in the stomach at the time of eating. If your stomach is empty, you will eat more than if some food is still present from a prior snack or meal. Initial hunger level. If you begin a meal or snack in a famished state, you are more likely to overeat and override satiety mechanisms. Social influence. Eating with other people can influence how much you eat. Studies have shown that the more people gathered at a meal, the more people tend to eat. Eating with others increases the duration of the meal. Eating more on weekends is usually due to being around people. Dieters, however, have been shown to eat less when they know someone is watching them. The same can be true for non-dieters when they dine with a model eater. In one study, when the model eater refrained from eating, so too did the non-dieter. There's a tendency to ignore or be distracted from biological signals in social settings. We have found that the key to the social dilemma is to continue making eating a conscious activity with purposeful food choices. Clearly, there are many factors that influence how full you feel from eating. With so many variables that exert influence on your eating, it should be no surprise, then, that the amount of food that you desire to eat can and will fluctuate. A big key is to stay tuned in and remember conscious eating. Beware of air food. Simply shoving some food in your mouth like a pacifier to ease hunger pangs may backfire, and the comforting effect will not be long-lasting. This is especially true for air food, food that fills up the stomach, but but offers little sustenance. Air food includes such low-calorie foods as air-popped popcorn, pirate's booty, rice cakes, puffed rice cereal, fat-free crackers, celery sticks, and calorie-free beverages. There's nothing inherently wrong with these